Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your ultimate window into everything new and noteworthy in the world of food and cooking. I'm your host, Kara Rhoda. Our guest today is Adrienne Rose Bitar, an American cultural critic specializing in food health and the concepts of American civilization. She's here to talk about her new book, Diet and the Disease of Civilization. Adrienne, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Talk to me first about diet books and the premise of this book, what you hope to explore and debunk, and really the messages that you are trying to get out in writing it.
Mm-hmm. Over the course of the 6 or 7 years I spent writing and researching this book, I must have read nearly 500 diet books. And time again, I was surprised by how difficult it was to get bored. I found in diet books both a really rich insight into the American psyche and American hopes and American dreams and the culture at large, but also relevant to this discussion is a culinary history that's often been overlooked or ridiculed unfairly. So when I set out to write this book, I both wanted to reveal the insights that diet books in general have revealed about the American character over the last 100 years, but also to sort of pay homage and respect the contributions diet books have made to culinary history, towards home cooking, and just the general culinary culture of the United States.
You talk a lot about how the diets that we consider popular in our modern world today, things like Paleolithic diet or detox diets, really tie into some of these fantasies that we have about what life used to be like or what it could ultimately be. Can you talk sort of about those fantasies and how diets allow us and maybe encourage us to engage in this aspirational, wishful thinking about what we want to be like as people?
Well, diet book is hope, simply put. Oftentimes they'll follow the really formulaic arc of, there's a reader or a dieter presumably unhappy with their lives. We can assume overweight, looking to become thin and beautiful and joyful through this process of dieting and following this, for lack of a better term, lifestyle plan. But if you look at diet books on the whole, it's not just this personal quest for self-improvement. It's not self-help in the way that's like selfish and individual and just a quest for individual beauty or individual joy, but rather they tell these stories about mankind and civilization and the downfall of humankind in general. So the Paleolithic diet is a really clear example of this because the diets aren't instructing you to follow this presumably Paleolithic way of life because you as an individual are best suited to it, but rather that humankind is optimally adapted to this one particular mythical moment in time in which everyone was healthy and everyone lived in social harmony and everyone was fit and got along well with one another and there wasn't warfare or depression or unkindness, or cruelty, or at the end of the day, unhealthy styles of living. So health is really bound up in this beautiful and big dream about the promise of civilization in its biggest sense.
Diet books contribute to the diet industry, obviously, which is huge. It's $60 billion. And that's a lot of hope. That's a lot of value that people are placing on that hope. Do you think there's a responsibility of diet books to work? And what would that even mean or look like?
Mm-hmm. So the most important distinction, and it's a tricky, fuzzy, muddy one, is to say that the diet industry and diet books are fairly separate. So the diet industry can include the sort of huckster snake oil peddling of, unhealthy supplements and, really marked up foods that are oftentimes, dangerous and unhealthy. And diet books also contribute to that But what diet books do is they tell a story that is really persuasive about how, you know, human health and human history. That being said, how do you judge the success or failure of a diet? Because it is literature in a sense. So you could judge a diet by pounds lost, in which case very few of them succeed. Or you could judge a diet by people's willingness to believe, or the sort of persuasiveness of the story, or just the imaginative rich world that the diet book evokes. So it's a really tricky boundary between looking at these like literature, and literature bears no responsibility to the readership to, you know, look out for their best interest, or looking at them as medical advice, which of course has, you know, real consequences, and people can, and authors can be held liable for poor medical advice portrayed as authoritative.
I think now part of what we're seeing, and tell me if you disagree, in the cookbook market is a trend towards the sort of healthy-ish, whole food, real food, a certain lifestyle of eating that isn't a particular diet and doesn't seem to have necessarily any criteria. What do you think about that and sort of the rise of flexitarianism and maybe this sort of consciousness or awareness about the idea of eating healthy, but that doesn't seem to necessarily correlate to eating a specific way?
The first thing you'd have to think about is what the definition of real foods are. So, and to think that through, it's helpful to think about what it isn't. And that shows really there are strict structures in place that offer a diet regimen. So what isn't a real food? Is it a food with, you know, artificial ingredients or dyes or overly processed, you know, method of preparation? So if you segment out what it is and what it isn't, you can see that there really is a strict definition. So a real food could be apple, but then would applesauce count, or would, you know, apple candy count? So you'd have to see what the definitions really are. And then once you find that definition, you can see that actually these wellness plans are oftentimes euphemisms for what could be called a diet. But at the same time, there is bubbling up a more generous approach to eating politically or eating healthily that allows for more choice on the part of the consumer, or we can say dieter. It's also a little bit of a red herring to say that it's so different these days, because if you look back through the history of diet books and the alternative food movement, you'll see that even back in the 19th century, there was political movements to reform diets based on religious conviction or political party that probably aren't as different for today's diets than they might at first glance seem.
You mentioned this overlap between sort of eating for dietary reasons and eating for political reasons. And I think that's something that we're at least familiar with when we think about sourcing, what it means to eat locally, what it means to support certain processes that we might want to create more of in the food movement. Can you talk a little bit about food justice and how it intersects with diet and the diet industry and diet books and the sort of idea of eating morally or eating ethically as a part of this too?
Mm-hmm. So the modern, what historians usually point to as the modern food justice movement would be the Great Boycott, Cesar Chavez's major Great Boycott that protested the poor working conditions of migrant laborers. And this was one of the first moments of food, like consumer food activism, that was really mainstream. It was at that time, if you were serving grapes at dinner, sort of seen as socially unacceptable or taboo, and the boycott lasted for a long time. So food justice and food activism is part of the whole process of defining yourself as an eater. And I think the idea that diet and morality are linked could be even more sort of fundamental than these specific protests or specific moments of consumer food activism, like the Great Boycott. If you go back as far as Sylvester Graham, Graham cracker fame, back in the 19th century, you'll see that his whole motivation for creating these graham crackers was a quest for like religious and spiritual purity, because the idea was that bland foods sort of suppressed sexual desire.
And I've heard similarly cornflakes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John Harvey Kellogg. That whole sort of cereal empire was built on this quest for religious and spiritual and sexual purity. So is that very different from today's sort of moral food eating? Sure, because it's not as politically informed. It isn't sort of looking at sourcing and labor. But in a really fundamental sense, everyone who's ever had a meal probably has considered where it comes from and how it affects their body.
I have to ask you, Adrian, because this is a podcast where we usually ask our authors sort of about their own food philosophy. How do you eat and cook, and has it changed over the course of you doing the research for this book?
It's really tough. So every time I read a diet book, which is very, very often, usually the author is really persuasive. So if you're ready to believe that, you know, the low-fat way of life is the one best suited to you, you're very much inclined to just follow whatever diet book of the moment I'm reading. And then the scientific study that has persuaded me the most is that the best indicator of a diet's success is the level of adherence to that diet. So it's really circular. So it's basically, you can give anyone any diet, and if they follow that diet, it will work. So low calorie, low fat, Atkins, high protein, et cetera. If you follow the diet religiously, it will work. So for me, especially once I read a diet book and I sort of adopt its principles, you know, I can take that into my life and just sort of generate my my own food philosophies. In particular, I've been really persuaded by the diets that take into account the environmental impact of eating. So looking at how, you know, meat and agriculture, especially livestock production, consumes enormous resources. That is really persuasive to me because it shows that, you know, eating is an agricultural act, eating is an environmental act, and we can try to balance out our own wishes for greater health with, you know, environmental considerations of nature and the health of the planet.
Adrian, this is so fascinating. It's such a great book, and I hope that people check it out. You can learn a lot more. It's called Diet and the Disease of Civilization, and thank you so much for coming to talk with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Tune in next week on The Clever Cookster for everything new and noteworthy in the world of food and cooking.